job. MIT does a very good job. Quite possibly RPI, eventually a Polytech Institute. But the number of schools that teach electrical engineering in a useful engineering manner, you can count them on one hand. There's a hell of a lot of electrical engineering schools in the United States. The majority of them teach it in a way that you almost can't use it. It is a pure memorization of all the ways of manipulating Maxwell's equations, and that's not the way it really takes place in the real world. Let me drop it. I went to what some people thought at the time was a pretty good electrical engineering school, Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York. It's no longer an engineering school. They've dropped engineering after 100 years of doing it, which is crazy, but they did. And I walked out of that school saying that microwaves, boy, that's the most boring thing in the world. I'm never going to work there. And I worked into a company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory and ran into a guy named Hank Keen, W2CTK. And Hank Keen was doing a waveguide experiment across the hall, and I heard high-power radar signals, literally, arcing across a piece of L-band waveguide. And I found out he's a ham. I found out what he was doing. He was the rotary joint expert for the radar antennas for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and I started talking to him. Wow. Did he have an impact on my life? And a year after I started talking to him, out came my first article in Stripline Transmitters that was published in Ham Radio Magazine, February 1972. And then eventually came out a year or two later, the parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432 with Stripline. And that Stripline came from the education I got by talking to this guy named Henry Keene, because he was one of the developers of Stripline way back in the middle 1950 period. And here I am in 1964, and he's teaching that to me. And what an experience that was. Let me drop. So, you got to be a little bit careful as to how you choose the method of education, as I say. There are places where you can spend a lot of time and a lot of money, and they're going to be giving you a nice degree and a nice sheepskin, but it might not be useful engineering information. I know that's kind of negative sounding. What you're hearing is an opinion. Not everybody's going to agree with that opinion. And I know that in the future you're going to have some more questions on transmission lines, directional couplers. We haven't even covered hybrids and filter hybrid combinations, duplexing filters. Oh, there's a whole lot of components you're going to want to know about, John. And in the future weeks, you're going to be asking it, and we'll be looking forward to you. I'm now going to move on because we've been keeping Joe waiting for quite a period of time. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. What would you like to talk about tonight, Joe? K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. W-H-4-Y-Y. Well, my question is, carried from last week, I haven't had time to get into it. I have a commercial antenna using the amateur band, and the bottom of the antenna has a metal sleeve that covers the coax junction to the antenna, and this antenna is normally used for outdoor applications. I can't seem to get that sleeve off. The base of the antenna is constructed of aluminum, and so is the sleeve. It had a set screw going through the outer sleeve, touching the threads on the antenna, but that set screw is no longer there anymore. But now it has nothing apparently visible to stop it from coming off the antenna yet. I can still not get it to move at all. Do either you or anybody out there in TechNet land have any kind of suggestions where I might be able to remove the sleeve, because I need to take off this jumper off the bottom of the antenna to try to test it further, see if I can still use the antenna. It's got some sort of an internal problem with it. Back to you.
Give us a few more words, Joe, before I open it to the net. What's the brand name of the antenna and the frequency range it operates? It sounds to me like it's a vertical, miniature station master-like thing with the sleeve, where the coax cable goes up the sleeve as a partial weatherproofing device. So with that brand name, that may help. Also, I know that you used to be able to go into a hardware store, and I wish I could think of the name of the stuff. They made a version of it for steel. They made a version of it for aluminum, where you spread this gel, this jelly, onto your aluminum surface, let it sit there and soak for a while. In the case of the aluminum stuff, it literally ate up the aluminum oxide. Didn't affect the aluminum, but ate up the aluminum oxide. I am guessing that there's a layer of aluminum oxide between those two chunks of aluminum that are telescoped together to give you a sleeve. And that corrosion is what's aggravating it. So I'd like to believe there's some chemistry that can be put in there that'll break down that corrosion so that way you can now move that device that's now jammed without damaging it. So what's the brand name on that antenna, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW.
I'll get to that in a moment. The section of the bottom of the antenna is not a telescoping type of effect. It's threaded. It has threads on its inside, and there are threads at the bottom of the antenna that match the threads of that sleeve. So it's actually threads together, you know, screws on like you screw pipes together, so to speak. So it's not a telescoping effect. The antenna is a cell wave, Orfeldt-Dodge, PD501, and is used in the 440 to 450 megahertz region.
Yeah, it's not too different than the problem I ran into that I was mentioning last week of these very well-made transco relays that I've got, extremely well-made transco relays. And because I was using them mounted in such a way where the coax cables were, the type N connectors, male connectors on the end of them were aimed upward, and it was part of the phasing harness of my array of 16 Yagis that you'll see as that picture at Mike number 2's site, LiveArcTechnet.com, or is it .org, keep forgetting. Anyhow, you'll see a picture of an array of 16 Yagis, which had a very complicated phasing harness, by which I could flip those relays so that I send all the signals to 16 Yagis all at once, or one vertical column of 4 Yagis, or the one very top Yagi. Those are my 3 zoom control positions by way of those relays. Well, those relays were mounted with the coax cable aimed upward. Therefore, water got into those threads. The water goes down to the bottom of the nut of the type N connector, where there's a rubber washer, and the water sat there forever. And because it was a less than ideal brand of type N connector, which constituted a dissimilar metal, those threads are really frozen. In my case, I had to take them apart with a Dremel tool and separate the 2 shells, if you know what I mean. Because I wasn't smart enough to find the right chemistry. There's got to be some chemistry somewhere. Let me drop.
I had an idea.
Yeah, I'm going to be handing it over to Andy in a minute. Somebody must make a chemistry that can be dropped, that can be soaked it down into those threads, which will eat up the aluminum oxide. I'm guessing it's aluminum oxide, although there is a slim possibility. I'd like to believe, though, that cell wave wouldn't have done dissimilar metals. I'd like to believe they're smart enough, but maybe a production run of one of those sleeves was a slightly different metal with between the male threads and the female threads, and those dissimilar metals created a welding action. But even with that welding action and or aluminum oxide corrosion building up, I think somebody builds chemistry that'll go in there and help. Let's see what Andy's got to say. I wonder if you run into that problem, Andy. To B2CDL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, good evening, Dick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a similar problem. What I did was I heated it up with a heat gun. It was actually a similar antenna with that the threads were so tight, bogged down is the word I'm thinking of. Whatever I did, I just couldn't loosen it. So I heated it up, and I forget exactly what temperature I heated it to, and then lightly with a ball peen hammer, I just banged or tapped the perimeter of the sleeve to sort of shake it, and you know, shake the and have the whatever was binding it together, you know, loose. Heating it up, melted it enough, and then, to my surprise, just by taking a one of those tongue and groove pliers, I wrapped it around the sleeve and gave it a little tug, and sure enough, it just loosened up, and I was able to unthread it. So maybe you could try that. Dick, back to you.
That's an excellent solution, Andy. I wish I had thought of that. If you are able to heat the outer sleeve fast enough, because of thermal expansion, it'll expand faster than the inner sleeve, and even if you can't heat it fast enough, but if you could heat it fast enough, the differential expansion will definitely loosening up those threads. That combined with shocking it with a hammer is going to go further to loosening it. Indoor chemistry. I would do the heating first, because I'm a little bit worried about if you put the chemistry in there and then heat it up, the chemistry could make a glue, if you know what I mean. So you use the heat gun. As long as you can do it without damaging other parts, I'd be tempted to use a Bernzomatic torch. I can get a lot more heat in there. Don't go anywhere near the point where you start melting the aluminum, but that differential expansion is really going to do good things. Let me drop it. The worst corrosion situation I can think of is the ordinary yucky steel U-bolts that are used on a muffler system of an automobile. And if you're trying to operate on that muffler system 8 years downrange from when the car was manufactured, that nut on that U-bolt is so well rusted. No way in hell could you move that without applying so darn much torque that you're going to literally just twist away the shaft of the U-bolt. However, you heat it up until it's glowing with a torch, and all of a sudden it'll make a lot of squeaking sounds, but boy, will it move. So therefore, you have the ability of that heavily rusted U-bolt on your muffler system. You can take it apart without damaging it with a heat gun, with a blowtorch. So differential expansion of threaded, corroded materials, good old heat can do an awful good job. I think that's worth a try, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, well, I have a small portable torch that I can certainly take that outside and give it a try when the weather gets a little predictably warmer. And I can attach it to something where I can get the antenna rigid and then try to get the heat to sleeve up rather quickly with putting some pressure on at the same time, and also using a I got a nice 5-pound hammer that'll help. So it all helps. All the ideas help, you know. Sometimes you don't know everything there is to know about a particular subject. So I'll give it a try and see what happens. If that doesn't work, I guess I'll have to look around or ask in a hardware store if they have some sort of, you know, stuff that is able to get in or between the threads of part A and part B and try to loosen the dissimilarity between them that's keeping them, you know, stuck together.
Yeah, there's a whole series of chemistry called Rust Buster and Liquid Wrench. I don't think WD-40 would do a great deal, but some of that chemistry you can buy in a good hardware store. It's going to do the job. It's going to help. But I think the heat is going to give you more action. I would try the heat first. Various ways of applying the heat and a lot of force. And I think it's going to move. And if that doesn't work, then it's time to start applying the chemistry. I think it's going to do it. I should have done that with my fancy type-N transco relays. Although, yes, it's only the type-N connector male outer ring that I would be heating. Hopefully that I could heat that enough to loosen it without damaging the inside, the Teflon innards of the relay itself. Got to worry about that a little bit. Because the nice thing about those well-made transco relays is that some of them have numbers like 60 decibels of isolation as a single pole double throw relay at 10 or 18 gigahertz. 60 dB of isolation at that frequency is a very good trick. It's a very fancy way that they move the vanes inside that chamber that do that switching action with low viswire. I really like an electromechanical relay. A well-constructed electromechanical relay can have lots of dBs of isolation, very few dBs of insertion loss, and the only real disadvantage, of course, is they take something like 20 milliseconds to switch from point A to point B, and during that switching action, you better have the RF energy turned off. One of the not very well-known phenomena of electromechanical relays is that during the transition, when it's halfway between the normally closed and normally open position, halfway in between, to some degree, all three signals, all three contacts, are sending signals to each other. And if you've got let me make a number here. If you've got a kilowatt transmitter turned on while the relay is in motion, you're making a double mistake. First of all, some substantial amount of power is going to be poured into your low noise amplifier and probably damage it. And second of all, whenever you're switching a relay hot, as they call it, as opposed to cold, so it's with the RF energy or the current flowing, you're going to be getting arcing and sparking of those contacts as they're making and breaking. So if you're really smart, you make sure you've got the right kind of differential keying circuit on your TR relay to make sure the coax, to make sure the RF energy stops, then the command to the relay is flown. And if it's an ideal situation, your relay's got an auxiliary set of contacts telling you that the transition to the new switching position has taken place. Another set of auxiliary contacts get closed, which then in turn enables the transmitter, if you know what I mean. So you can have a double protection, the differential keying and also keying switching confirmation. And I think that relay I'm talking about had some of those extra functions in there, and it was magnetically latching. That's the nicest kind of TR relay, where you give it a command to go from the receive mode to the transmit mode, and it stays there and latches, magnetically latches. Then you give it a command to go from the transmit mode back to the receive mode, and it draws current momentarily, and then magnetically latches. It doesn't have to sit there drawing current continuously and getting hot. That's a nice relay. And so, I think brand new, those things are like $1,000 a piece. I think I bought them at a flea market for like $20. I think there was a couple more of them. I wish I had bought more of them at the time. I've never seen them again. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of people who signed in tonight with a question.
Comment on Joe's problem.
Go right ahead.
I have a of a comment I'd also like to add from last week, but go ahead, continue.
Yeah, we're going to go to John and to Joe in that order. You got it, John.
DC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone there. Yes, the threads are tighten it up as much as you can and give it a whack with a light ball-peen hammer against the hard surface. As that distorts with each whack, it's going to crumble up. That it's like a sand that builds up in there. And just keep tapping it around, and some penetrating oil, you'll be able to take it off of your hand.
Another good sounding suggestion, John. First of all, he's got this tubular outer thing, which has got threads on the inner surface of the tubular thing, and it in turn is screwed onto something that's got threads on the outer surface. Why would you put a hose clamp on there? I'm going to make a guess that the hose clamp gives you the ability to whack the piece of tubing in such a way that when you're hitting the hose clamp, you're creating a turning torque. That's what I think is going on. Is that what's happening here, John? KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Well, yes, you can do that by hitting the screw fitting that would give it a angular structure. It'll come in on a tangent. But the idea of the stainless steel band is it will prevent the aluminum from distorting. If it distorts, you can wind up with something slightly egg-shaped. You'll never get it off. Every time you hit it and you rotate it, hit it again, it brings it back. That clamp will bring it back to that perfect circle. It won't allow it to distort, you know, if you don't overpower it with the hits. But that's the idea of the hose clamp. And a little penetrating oil, it works all the time. Never had an issue with it.
And when you did that, John, were you moving an aluminum set of frozen threads? Go ahead.
Yes, there was a reducer fitting threaded into a pipe. The pipe had internal threads, and when you aluminum or aluminum stainless steel, you get that buildup of the aluminum oxide like sand in there, and it attaches itself to that aluminum. And if you use vice grips or anything, you're going to just scar it up and distort the hell out of it. So gentle action with the ball-peen hammer. With the stainless steel, you won't even be able to scratch the aluminum, because it's very hard, that stainless steel. And a little penetrating oil, and it works. I've never had a fail.
Glad to hear that, John. Joe, go right ahead with your comment. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, the comment is a carryover from another subject I brought up on the TechNet a few weeks ago, two or three or four ago, something like that. And that was where my computer power supply was putting out interference on RF channel 3 of the television band. 60 to 66 megahertz. Well, what I did was I took some measurements, and I didn't find too much in the way of interference coming out, and it was a little hard to see, you know, something on the line side whether something was low level coming out with, you know, like an EC wave going in. Very hard. I couldn't get that kind of differential. But what I ended up just simply doing is I took 3.047 caps, 50 volt rating, and put them on the 5 volt line, 3.3 volt line, and 12 volt line on the output of the regulator section of the power supply. And on the input side, I used 2.003 microfarad 1600 volt caps from each leg of the AC line, the white leg and the black leg, to ground. That whole process eliminated the problem. I did this also by setting the power supply up and being able to trigger it out of the computer, working on the table. Okay? And I had a spectrum analyzer with an antenna lead next to it, so I had a before and after measurement of what the effect was of the radiated noise looking at 60, at about 60 megahertz. Dropped the noise then about 20 to 25 dB. So apparently some of it being radiated out of the case, some of it could have been radiated out of back out of the AC line itself, but the whole process eliminated my problem for me. Back to you.
Well done, Joe. Now, you almost eliminated the problem at the source. In fact, you did. And I know that other people were suggesting that you build an extra cage around the whole piece of equipment, which is what you do if everything else fails. But take the simple approach at first. And so I'm assuming those capacitors you described were just ceramic capacitors. It sounds to me like you added a couple of dollars worth of capacitors, and you made a 20 or 25 decibel improvement of the problem. And so I'm guessing that was only a couple of dollars worth of capacitors. What do you think, Joe? It's something probably you had in your junk box.
Yeah, well, a couple I had to buy from Radio Shack, the 0.047, but the 0.003s, I actually bought a bag of those from a couple of years back using them on my GE power supplies to give me some filtering across the diodes. And I purposely bought 1600 volt caps, DC rating caps. And that took care of that. But interestingly enough, I couldn't remember what the value was of the capacitor, even though I knew they were all marked like 3300Z on the cap. I come up with another unique way of figuring out the reactance to the capacitor using a variable transformers to run the voltage down to it when I put it into a voltage divider network with a resistor. And I figured out what the reacts and then thusly what the value of the cap should have been. So that's why I know it's the 0.003. I guess the exact value doesn't become that terribly critical, but it gave me enough reactance at 60 megahertz to be like, you know, less than an ohm of a reactance, something like 0.8, so it definitely solved the problem for me without putting like ferrite beads. And I couldn't have put a metal shield around the whole power supply, because this power supply goes into a desktop computer, and there's only space to put the power supply itself in the desktop. You can't put anything else around it, otherwise you'd never be able to fit it in there.
Yeah, what you did is very crafty, Joe. It's hard to believe that a capacitor that maybe was designed to be used at 100 megahertz, that you can easily measuring roughly how many picofarads it's got by doing a 60 hertz measurement, a 60 cycle transformer, 6.3 volts, for instance, going through the capacitor, and then the output of that goes into a known impedance, like a 10 megohm input impedance voltmeter, AC voltmeter. Your modern day digital voltmeter is around 10 megohms of input. In the old days, a Hewlett-Packard, here we go, a vacuum tube voltmeter made by Heathkit, a V7A, I think it was, is a very handy way of measuring the voltage that goes through the capacitor into the known impedance, the 10 megohms of the meter, and you measure the AC voltage, and there's a direct relationship. I've got this little chart taped to the side of my Heathkit AC VTVM for the last 30 years. There was an article in Popular Electronics a zillion years ago that if you put this extra connector on the front panel, let me drop it. You put this extra connector on the front panel of the AC VTVM, extra pair of connectors, which taps into the 6-volt power supply. One lead taps into the 6-volt power supply. The other lead goes internally to the AC input to the meter, the probe input. And now you put your capacitor across these two connectors. And depending on the voltage you read on the 3-volt AC scale Well, I think you sometimes go to the 10-volt, but I think most of it's the 3-volt AC scale. And so you can read all the way down to a couple of picofarad, all the way up to something like 0.01, as I remember, or maybe it's 0.1 microfarad, by measuring the AC voltage flowing through. So, you know, a capacitor reactance is 1 over 2 pi square root of LC. No, that's frequency. 1 over 2 pi, 1 over 2 pi FC. There it is, 1 over 2 pi FC. By knowing the amount of capacitor reactance at 60 hertz, you can calculate with 5 or 10% accuracy exactly how many picofarad is that capacitor. And so it's kind of hard to believe that 60 hertz can measure a capacitor that's intended to be used at 60 megahertz. Works like a charm when you get high impedance meters. Whenever I mention it to people, they usually look at me kind of strange. Why would I use that to measure the capacitance? Why don't they go out and buy a capacitance measuring meter? Well, if you happen not to have one, in a pinch, you can do it this way. And there's even ways you could do that with a 110-volt AC line, as long as you got a high enough voltage rating of a known impedance on your AC voltmeter. Your digital voltmeter will do that for you very nicely. A simple calculation will tell you exactly what it is. Okay, Joe, here we go. John, what kind of questions did we get in the mailbag this week? I think last week we only had a small number of questions we only had time for. We got to make up some back time here, John.
Repeater, timeout.
So KC2WGV, K2RIW, take it away, John.
Gentleman that has a transmitter, he can do 20 and 40 meters, and he has a tuner. The tuner works fine on 20 meters. He has a problem on 40. It won't tune properly. So what he did was, listening to the TechNet, he took a little wooden stick, a chopstick, and on that he put an insulated plate of copper. It's a half inch wide, 3 inches long. He noticed, he took the cover off the tuner, and when he was trying to tune the 40 meter band, he placed that copper strip near the tuning capacitor and moved it around and found out he can get a good match. Now, what is that telling him, and what should he do to correct the problem? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I do a whole lot of tuning with a small amount of copper tape on the end of a wooden stick. And I'm doing that at 915 megahertz. And in some cases, I'm adding about 1 or 2 or 5 picofarad by holding it near the tip of an element of a antenna that I'm tuning at 915 megahertz. So these pieces of copper tape on the end of a wooden stick are very good for adding maybe as much as 100 picofarad if you do it just right. But you're not going to get a 0.1 microfarad out of that unless you use two very great big sheets, if you know what I mean. So knowing that it's only a few picofarads, and when you weigh down at 40 meters, 7 megahertz, where the variable capacitor, your antenna tuner, in many cases, the antenna tuner really is a PI network, a PI impedance matching network. It's got a C1 capacitor to ground, a L1 inductor between input and output, and a C2 capacitor to ground at the output. And those two capacitors are variable, and the inductor quite often is usually a fixed inductor, and you've got a rotary switch on the front panel of the antenna tuner in many cases, where you adjust you rotate that switch until you're in the 40 meter position, the 20 meter position, and so on. What you're really doing is you're selecting the correct tap on that inductor, is the usual way it's done. In some cases, the switch has got multiple gangs to it, where you're selecting the right tap on the inductor, shorting out some of those turns, so to speak. At the same time, you're adding or subtracting more or less capacitance to the C1 area or the C2 area. So that's one way an antenna tuner is often designed. Let me drop. And sometimes the antenna tuner is a very simple device where it's just an L network, one inductor and one variable capacitor. Trouble is that when you set up that way, that method of it, of setting up the topography of the antenna tuner, if it's only one inductor and one capacitor, depending on which way you use it, you can always step up in impedance, but not step down, or vice versa. Whereas in the case of a Pi network properly designed can step up the impedance or step down the impedance. A well-designed Pi network at the frequencies where it's rated for, as far as the output impedance is concerned, you might be able to match from 5 ohms to 500 ohms, so to speak. And 50 ohms is the ideal middle, if you know what I mean. So by adjusting the right value of C1 and C2 with the right selection of the number of turns of the inductor in between, you could probably match 5 ohms to 500 ohms in the resistor value and quite a few other values of reactance in between when you get some capacitance or inductance left over on your load. Let me drop. So I think it's time to do a very careful inspection of the rotary switch. If there's a switch in there that selects 20 meters versus 40 meters and so on, and there is a bad contact somewhere, that particular tank of a switch is not making contact, a particular ground is not making, a good visual inspection, and in some cases, you can have a lug that goes to ground or a lug that goes to the switch, and it looks perfectly good to the eye, but it might really be a microscopic crack or a cold solder joint. When in doubt, put your two probes of your ohmmeter across a suspicious joint to really be sure that point A is really making good contact to point B. So if a simple gimmick capacitor that you're describing, a chunk of copper on the end of a stick, is able to tune it, it sounds to me like something in there is a complete open circuit that's not supposed to be an open circuit. And I'm kind of amazed that way down at 40 meters, 7 megacycles, that a gimmick capacitor brought you into range. Now, there's also a slim possibility here, let me drop, that the particular antenna on, say, 40 meters happens to be a high enough standing wave ratio that it's out of the range of VISWAR that can be accommodated by that particular brand name of antenna tuner. And maybe one of those capacitors, in order to hit resonance, had to go to, let me pick a number, 300 picofarad, and the variable capacitor only went to 295. And by way of your gimmick capacitor, you added the extra 5 picofarad and hit resonance. There's a slim possibility that happened if you've got a load that is so high in VISWAR that it's essentially out of range. But I'm kind of doubting that. I think it's more likely there's an open circuit in there that's got to be found. For all we know, it's been dropped, or it's got a cold solder joint, a crack in the printed circuit board, something along those lines. I would take it apart and do a real good visual inspection under a bright light, John. KC2 WGB, K2RIW the TechNet.
Yes, I agree, Dick. That sounds like a good thing to do. Also, this is a roller inductor with 2 variable capacitors. So it could also be that the roller inductor might have some dirt on it at the contact points when he's at the 40-meter area. So that would be another thing I would suggest for him to look at. But I was amazed it is a big chunk of copper. It's maybe 3/8 of an inch thick, inch wide, 2 or 3 inches long. So it's not like tape. But, a couple of picofarads. I don't know about that, but all right, good suggestion. Let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next one.
Give me a couple more words on this. This piece of copper, was that being held in his fingers, or was it held on the end of a wooden stick? And the size of the copper you're describing, yeah, you could hit 100 picofarad of straight capacitance with a thing like that. And so I guess it's possible that one of the capacitors didn't quite bring you into range and have carefully held the extra 100 picofarad. If it's against another flat plate, you get a lot of area of the two plates. You can easily hit on 100 picofarad, what you described. Do you think that was handheld or on the end of a wooden stick, John? Go ahead.
He actually fixed it to a chopstick, a wooden stick, and he had to put some scotch tape on it to provide some insulation because he had to get extremely close to the capacitors. And he didn't want it to short it out. So it's on a wooden stick thing.
Well done. One of the things that I discovered way up at 915 megacycles, that scotch tape makes an extremely good dielectric. By that I mean, you take pieces of copper tape, sandwiched with scotch tape in between. You can make a whole lot of picofarads of capacitance, and that's a very high quality capacitor at 915 megs. I wasn't able to measure the loss. I expected the glue and the plastic that's inside of scotch tape to be a very lossy material at 915 megs. And to my great surprise, it was an extremely low loss material. Not quite as good as a sheet of Teflon, but it wasn't bad. And in fact, what I was doing in many cases, when I wanted to build a variable capacitor against a printed circuit board, a variable capacitor ground, what I've done on a number of occasions is to lay down a piece of scotch tape on the printed circuit board, lay a piece of copper tape on top of it, and one end of the copper tape gets soldered down to the circuit where I want to make a variable capacitor. Let me drop. So, in other words, I start off with a nice big capacitor, so to speak. Scotch tape laying on top of the copper tape, one layer of scotch tape on top of the printed circuit board ground, and then a layer of copper tape on top of that, one end of which is connected to the circuit in question. And then, with a pair of wooden tweezers, or fiberglass tweezers, I grab the other end of the copper tape and slowly start peeling it away from the scotch tape. And that's a variable capacitor where, with that technique, you could easily make a 200 picofarad capacitor that, as you peel it away, it goes from 200 picofarad down to 1 picofarad. And I'm not kidding. And you try to buy a variable capacitor that's got that much range of C-max to C-min, 1 picofarad to 200. It doesn't exist. By way of this peeling copper tape with scotch tape, you could easily build that. And if you wanted to, by stretching it even further, I could probably go up to 1,000 picofarad by just making more area of the copper tape, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John. K2RIW, the Tech Man.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize it's not that difficult to make capacitors. And once you get the exact value you need, you know, you can trim off the excess and then even put a little varnish on it or whatever, lacquer, and it will last forever. Yeah, that's good stuff. Alrighty. Now, let me pick up the next one. KC2WGB.
Yeah, before you leave this one, John, by way of this tuning technique, you can find out exactly how many picofarad you want. Once you find this peeling technique and you peel it until you get the right value, now, by disconnecting it from the circuit and by using a 60-cycle circuit to measure the capacitor reactance, with 5% accuracy, you can measure how many picofarad you've got. Now you can go out and buy that exact number of picofarad as a disc ceramic capacitor, if you know what I mean, if you want something that really has longevity. Yes, there's ways of taking the copper tape with scotch tape and putting varnish on it or lacquer or whatever or Krylon spraying it. There's ways you can make it a little bit more permanent, but it is a gimmick capacitor. But there's ways that once you find what the circuit wants, you can now put the real thing in there. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick, and it does work. In fact, I used a thing similar to that with some 2-inch wide copper on scotch tape, white scotch tape, the strapping tape, and I used that as a tuning device on the end of a stub which was attached to an antenna, and I just rolled it back just like you said until I found out the exact match, could see on the spectrum analyzer exactly where it had to be, and that worked fine. Yes, that works very well.
Did you do that peeling with fiberglass tweezers, John?
A plastic knitting needle, and I rolled it back. It rolled up on the knitting needle as I twirled the knitting needle against the tape, and it just removed it little by little, and it you could watch it move on the spectrum analyzer as you were rolling it, and it worked perfectly.
Very crafty.
KC2WGB. Okay, I have a gentleman here who has a wine shell attenuator, and he's confused. All right, the loss, the throughput loss is 0.4 dB at 1 gig. Then it has a correction tape. It's variable between 1 and, 0 and 10 dB of attenuation, this attenuator. But the correction factor says at 1 gig, at the 3 dB position, you have positive 0.4. 6 dB, the correction factor is 0.1. At the 10 dB attenuation point, it is minus 0.4. Now he wants to do, what do you do with those numbers? Do you add the positive ones and subtract the negative ones? How does that work? Maybe you could give him a tip on that.
There's always a little bit of ambiguity in this one, John. I'd like to believe Weinchel, an extremely well-respected manufacturer of electronic components, and I think they may have been sold to another company recently, but they made some very high-power attenuators. I'd like to believe that 3 dB, is the correction factor is 0.4, 6 dB correction factor 0.1, 10 dB correction factor minus 0.4. You're now asking, each of those three numbers, do you add them or subtract them to come up with the real number? That's a good question. And depending on how they call it, do they call it the correction factor? Do they call it there's a couple of different ways. I'm going to guess that it's a positive correction factor. In other words, when you're at 3 dB and the correction is 0.4, does that mean you really have 3.4 dB? Or do you really have 2.6 dB? I think you add, and I think your 3 dB is really 3.4. But I wouldn't guarantee it. And that's a tough one, John. Now, when it comes to the correction factors they've got on the side of your power detecting head for a power meter, you have a similar problem there. Do you add or subtract those correction factors, or error factor? In fact, there's a good question for you. When it comes to adding or subtracting, let me drop it. In some cases, those extra little numbers are called error factor. Sometimes they're called correction factor. Usually they're called correction factor. And now, if for instance, it is a power detecting head, and it's at the 3 dB reading, 3 dBm reading, and the correction factor happened to be 0.4 of a dB, does that mean the real power you're reading will indicate 3.4, even though it's really 3.0 dBm? Or, because it's got 0.4 of a dB of correction, that when it reads 3, it really is 2.6? I ain't sure, John, as you can tell. And I'd like to believe there's a website somewhere that's going to give us some further information. In the case of Weinchel, I'd like to believe they've got a website that might give you a hint if you read deep enough into the owner's manual of that machine. So when he finds out, can you ask him to please come back and tell us? Because I'm not sure. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Very good, Dick. Well, I have a couple of Weinchel attenuators. And from my understanding, at 1 gigahertz with those ratings, if you're measuring a 3 dB, you're going to add the 0.4. At 6 dB, you're going to add 0.1. Now, when you get to the 10 dB, you're going to add minus 0.4. It's total addition, as far as I am aware of, and that seems to work out according to the attenuation and regions on my vector network analyzer when I use them. Now, it definitely says correction label. It's a correction factor label. So, and with it starting out the insertion loss of the entire device is 0.6. So you would have to make those adjustment calculations and take in the fact that it has a 0.6 loss for itself. And that's probably why they have this correction table. It's a very accurate looking device.
I think I agree with you, John. So when the Weinchel attenuator is set at zero, you've really got 0.4. When it's set at 3 dB, you got a correction factor of 0.4, so you're really getting 3.4. That seems to make some sense. However, if the correction factor is now the numbers along the side of your power detecting head of a power meter, and if the correction factor is at 1 gigahertz plus 0.4, does that mean when you're reading the power out of your signal generator and it reads plus 3 dBm. Is it really plus 3.4? Is the head reading too high or too low compared to real power when it's a correction factor for a power indicating head of a power meter? What's your guess on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2IW?
Well, if you look at the input signal at 0 dB, then you can calculate by these exact numbers subtracting them. But if you look at the curve it makes, 0.4 positive, 0.1 positive, and negative 0.4, you can envision that slope, and that is what you would apply to the 0 dBm input. But also, there is a 6 dB loss, a 0.6 dB loss for the entire device. So at some point, like when you're getting 0.1, you're getting a slight, it's showing the non-linearity, actually, of the device. That's how I read this.
Yeah, I do see how you can make a smooth curve out of the data we've just been given. 4/10 when it's at zero is, wait a minute, is it 4/10? Yeah, got correctly, 3D is 0.4610. So, when you select 10 dB on the Weinschild step attenuator, and there's a minus 0.4 correction factor, sounds like you're really getting 9.6 dB of attenuation. And going up in attenuation, getting less than desired, can definitely happen, depending on the physical layout. Some of the signal is bridging the gap, so to speak. So that's our best guess, John. But don't bet your life on this one, because there's a slim chance that some brand out there does it the other way. What would you, John?
Well, now you piqued my interest. I think I have a device. I think I might have that exact device in the warehouse. I'm going to go get it, and I'm going to put it on my spectrum analyzer and find out. All right, I'll move on to the next one. KC2WGB. Dick, I know you've done this a couple of times, but I have a young man who's interested in a circulator. He doesn't understand what are they used for, and he heard you discuss about some paramagnetic material or something in there that causes this function to happen. If you could just give him a quick rundown on circulators and what they're used for and basically how they work. That's it. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, 97% of the time, a circulator is used at a microwave frequency, usually above 1,000 megs. There are a few of them that have been built all the way down to 100 megs, but they start becoming very bulky. It is a three-terminal device. Usually it is a circular layout of the main package, and every 120 degrees around the perimeter there is a connector. Quite often there's an arrow on the front panel indicating direction of circulation. And so if I put a signal into port number one at the 12 o'clock position, and port number two comes out at the 4:30 position, signal put into port one comes out of port two. Correspondingly, signal put into port two comes out of port three at the 7:30 position, and so on, in that direction. So in other words, no matter where you put in the signal, it comes out of the next port. The signal, you could say, always goes clockwise. So, once again, if I'm putting a signal into port one, let me drop. I'm going to get essentially a full blast signal out of port two and nothing out of port three. You might, in fact, put a termination on port three just to make sure that any reflection from port two doesn't go anywhere. In other words, I could set this thing up that port number one comes from the transmitter. Port number two goes to the antenna. Port number three has a termination. If I use it in that manner, any standing wave ratio of the antenna that creates a reflected signal, all that reflected signal comes back to port two, which transfers the signal over to port three, where there's a 50 ohm termination, and the signal dies. The bottom line is now the transmitter, with the use of that circulator, never sees any standing wave ratio. In fact, even if you put an open circuit on port number two where you got the antenna connection, even if the cable breaks and all the signal is being reflected, If the circulator has high enough quality, all that reflected signal from the broken piece of cable goes into the termination on port number 3, and again, the transmitter always sees a 50-ohm load. So you can see the beauty of those things on the output of a transmitter to protect it from short circuits, open circuits, and whatever. You can also use them on the input of a low-noise amplifier, because many low-noise amplifiers behave very well if they see a 50-ohm source, and they behave very unpredictably if they see something else. Some very high-quality low-noise amplifiers in the old days were somewhat unstable. If you had the wrong input impedance on the input connector of a low-noise amplifier, in the old days, they used to break into oscillation. Nowadays, guys do a much more better, design, a computer-activated design, such that you design the low-noise amplifier in such a way to be essentially unconditionally stable, that any reasonable impedance on the input and the output, the thing won't break into oscillation. Well, some of the very high-performance transistors at the very high frequencies, there may not be a solution that gives you an unconditionally stable amplifier. It more likely is going to be a conditionally stable amplifier, in which case a liberal sprinkling of circulators can do an awful lot of good for you. I remember looking at some of the circuits that were being designed for microwave circuits by Bell Laboratories. When I visited the Bell Laboratories in Homedale, New Jersey, way back in the mid-70s, all of the circuits they designed had a liberal sprinkling of circulators all over the place. Now, how does a circulator do that? How does it violate reciprocity, so to speak? In other words, the signal flows in one direction in this three-terminal device in the clockwise direction, and it doesn't flow counterclockwise. And that's a function of using the right kind of magnetic material inside with the right magnitude of biasing magnet. The actual material inside is something very similar to YIG material, yttrium iron garnet. And the yttrium iron garnet material is using something at the molecular level called precession. In other words, the individual magnetic domains inside of the magnetic material are a little bit like a spinning top. You know, when you've got a top spinning on the table and you watch it wobble in a particular manner, that wobble is called precession. And depending on which direction you spin the top, the wobble is preordained. In other words, it's going to precess in a certain direction when you spin the top in a particular direction. It'll never precess in the other direction. There's a bunch of gyroscope physics going on there. Let me drop it. And if you had the ability to take your top on the table, and now the table is in an elevator, so to speak, and now you start accelerating the elevator. It's the pull of gravity on your top that's causing the rate of precession as well as the amount of gyroscopic action, which is a function of the rate at which the top is spinning. If by some magic you could force your top to always spin on its axis at a particular rate, now depending on the way the gravity acts on your top as it's a little bit off center, so to speak, a little over to one side, it will precess. If you now could accelerate the table so that the top thinks it's seeing twice as much gravity, you would find out that the top precesses twice as fast. That's a mechanical engineering equivalent to what's going on with the individual magnetic domains inside of this magnetic material. Let me drop. So, in the case of your top that's precessing, changing gravity will change the rate at which it precesses. In the case of the precessing of the magnetic material, changing the strength of the magnetic field changes the rate at which it precesses. In the case of a YIG filter, you change the strength of the magnetic field, you change the frequency at which it is tuning and passing signal from the input loop to the output loop. In the case of a YIG filter, the magnetic material is a perfectly round sphere with two loops of wire around the YIG sphere that are at right angles to each other, orthogonal to each other. Without the YIG sphere, because the two loops are at right angles, essentially no signal couples from the input loop to the output loop. But you put a piece of YIG material in there with the right strength of magnetic field, the input signal going into the magnetic material experiences the domain precession at the molecular level, at the atomic level, at the molecular level, and that in turn causes a coupling of the signals from the input loop to the output loop only at the rate of precession. And the rate of precession is a function of the strength of the magnetic field. So therefore, at that particular strength of magnetic field, a particular frequency will be coupled from the input filter, input loop to the output loop. A well-designed Higgs filter can easily tune from 2 to 18 gigahertz in an extremely linear manner by doing nothing but changing the magnetic field that each individual Higgs sphere sees. And it's a very nice linear filter, which, I mean, that's a whole lot of octaves of filtering, and it gives you a very beautiful a filter curve across that whole frequency region. Let me drop. By a similar technique, what's happening with the magnetic material inside of a circulator is that the signal that moves in the clockwise direction has a certain velocity of propagation. The signal that propagates in the counterclockwise direction around the three terminals of your circulator propagates at a slightly different direction. And when they arrange the geometry inside to be just right, there is always, when you put a signal into port number one, without a doubt, some of that signal is going to go into the magnetic material and propagate in the clockwise direction. Some of it's going to propagate in the counterclockwise direction. You can't stop it from doing that. But if you've got the clockwise velocity of propagation and the counterclockwise velocity of propagation just the right ratio, the signals will come out in phase at port number two and out of phase at port number one, at port number three, when the signal is going into port number one. So it's the difference in velocity of propagation, clockwise and counterclockwise, that gives you this isolation phenomena. Once you know that, let me drop. You'll be amazed how many smart radio amateurs went to a flea market where they really needed a circulator at 10.368 gigahertz, the frequency of their ham rig, and the thing that was on the table being sold at some extremely cheap price was an 8 gigahertz circulator or a 15 gigahertz circulator. In some cases, they took the 8 gigahertz circulator and cascaded another magnet on top of the magnet that's in there, increasing the magnetic field, so that instead of it tuning at 8, it tuned at 10. Or correspondingly, you take the circulator that's tuned for 15 gigs, and by one means or another, lower the magnetic field. In other words, break the glue and separate the magnet a little bit further, so that the magnetic material inside sees a lower magnitude of magnetic field, and what used to tune to 15 gigs now tunes to 10 gigs. So there's a lot of situations where these microwave guys talking to each other on the microwave reflector of WA1MBA taught each other how to tune a Higgs filter that they bought at a cheap price because it's on a crazy frequency that nobody wanted. We dropped it. And they either brought it up to or down to their favorite frequency by using refrigerator magnets. In fact, in some cases, they just add another refrigerator magnet on top with a bucking magnetic field, the opposite direction, as a method of lowering the magnetic field to tune it to a lower frequency. There's a lot more to the physics of what's going on, but at least this gives you a thumbnail sketch as to what's happening inside of those circulators. And now, in some cases, you buy a circulator which has the port number 3 50 ohm termination built in. In that case, you're not adding the termination, it's already built in, and so that kind of a circulator, they call it an isolator, because the signal will always flow from port 1 to port 2, but any signal you put into port 2 does not come out of port 1. So the signal will go in one direction. It's the radio, it's the microwave equivalent of a diode operation, so to speak. You can, on that isolator, the signal will flow in one direction, but not in the other direction. And there are many cases where you're building a circuit, and that's a very handy phenomenon. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, great explanation, Dick. Now, I'm going to make an assumption, maybe I'm wrong, but from your description, if we had a 100-watt transmitter which was going through the circulator through port 1, we had a perfect antenna, all of that signal is going out port 2. Now, if a failure happens on the antenna, and we have a dummy load on port 3, that dummy load should be rated for 100 watts because it possibly could see that. Is that correct?
As I usually say, give that man a cigar. You got it perfectly, John.